previously on the history of America's 1%.
So, yeah, we're talking about John Jacob Astor again. He's already been implicated in everything from land theft to murder to corruption to treason. But, was he ever charged with any crimes? Well, of course not. In fact, he was never even bothered with a summons to appear in court. So, while he's using brute force to run his fur monopoly in the West, he's using deception and cunning in the East to grab up land. In one instance, he buys up a large grant of land which was confiscated from the British during the Revolution, and then he kicks off all the settlers who had built and improved upon it. Despite bitter public outcry over the swindle, the New York legislature buys back the fraudulent land from Astor at 5 times the purchase price. Gus notes that these city councilors were notoriously corrupt bribe takers. And so the story goes. At least in New York and probably elsewhere, land is constantly given away or sold cheaply to local legislators or their friends. The common excuse they use is that the city needs revenues, but that's only because the people in charge have totally plundered the public treasury. But that's not all. Even more free gifts are given to Astor and others in New York. The streets are graded, the land underwater is drained and filled in, sewers are laid all by the city, and is paid for by the taxpayers. All of this exponentially increases the value of the city land and propels Astor's massive fortune while he simply sits back and watches.
You get up and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome back to yet another episode in the history of America's 1%, where we dive into the long and shadowy history of America's ruling elite through the works of authors who were either silenced, suppressed, or forgotten, and we hope to discover the origins of the American oligarchy, the people who actually run the country, and from where their power and wealth has been extracted. And we're going to be getting into episode 9 here with a further reading of the history of great American fortunes by a very important, very thorough, very methodical, and I would say he was one of the best muckrakers from the turn of the 20th century, Gustavus Myers. He published several volumes, and most of them have been largely forgotten by the public, I guess you can say. So anyways, we're going to press on here. We've been really looking at, I got to say, one of the first robber barons in America, and that would be John Jacob Astor. And in the last couple of chapters, it's really starting to hit home that the great fortunes, and I think he is still labeled as the richest American of all time when you adjust for inflation or his wealth compared to percent of GDP at the time, or they use some kind of calculation to calculate it. But I'm pretty sure you can pull up any list of the wealthiest Americans of all time, and John Jacob Astor will be sitting right at, if not near the top. So, the last couple chapters we've been reading is really starting to hit home that, this guy was probably, well, he's been implicated in, what did I say, land fraud, murder, theft, treason. I mean, I don't know what other crimes he could possibly be implicated in. And sure enough, Gus Myers made sure to note that he never even got a summons to appear in court. This guy broke the law brazenly. He did it wantonly. Oh my gosh, it's just ridiculous. But anyways, so I think now we're going to be getting into his banking activities, and this is definitely an area that, as Gus Myers notes, most of Astor's biographers never even bother to take a look at, which is a shame because, as we all know, yeah, banking is a good way to make a lot of money in a sub rosa type of way. So let's get right into it. As always with the History of America's 1% podcast, I'll be trying to keep, and I know I've been really terrible at this, but I will try to keep the recording down to 1 hour in length so it's easy to digest and listen to. I'll only be stopping to interject, I guess my own insights in the book. I always find some little fact that I like to elaborate on, and interpretation and things like that are good. Otherwise, I'll be stopping to spell last names because I butcher them quite often, or reading footnotes. If there's an informative footnote in the book, I will go ahead and read it. Otherwise, it'll be on the website. As always, you can find the latest iteration of it by going to Twitter and looking me up. My name is at fileandclaw322. Sometimes the footnotes are more than just a citation. Gus Myers, he's got some in here that are almost a page long in fine print. And so I like to add those in because the information in there has been, oh man, really topical, and I think you would be missing a lot of information in this book if I didn't add in the footnotes. So that's the reason I do that. Otherwise, let's get right into it now. This is going to be Volume 1, Part 2, Chapter 4 of The History of Great American Fortunes. And again, this was written by Gustavus Myers and published, I have a 1911 edition here, but it's freely available on Google or the Internet Archive, and I'd highly suggest you go take a look at that. But this is Chapter 4, The Ramifications of the Astor Fortune. Astor flourished at the precise time when the traders and landowners, flushed with revenues, reached out for the creation and control of the highly important business of professionally dealing in money, and of dictating personally and directly what the supply of the people's money should be. Oh yeah, this is going to get good, I can already tell. This signalized the next step in the aggrandizement of individual fortunes. The few who could center in themselves, by the grace of government, the banking and manipulation of the people's money, and the restricting or inflating of money issues, were immediately vested with an extraordinary power. It was a sovereign power at once coercive and proscriptive, and a mighty instrument for transferring the produce of the many to a small and exclusive coterie. Oh yeah, lay it on, brother. Tell me all about it. Not merely over the labor of the whole working class did this gripping process extend, but it was severely felt by the large part of the landowning and trading class, which was excluded from holding the same privileges. The banker became the master of the master. Wow, oh man, lay it on. Gus Myers knew what was going on. Listen to that. The master of the master. And that's, you know, really, that's great insight. I always think of the old saying of, like, follow the money, right? And you don't get much higher up in the old money trail than banks and bankers, because, well, like you just said, they can create or constrict the money supply. And that's, I mean, that's so concrete and to understand, so important, such a solid foundation in understanding where power and wealth and economic manipulation come from. And I think it's one saying that I always remember is that the hand that gives is always above the hand that takes. That would make the banks the masters of the masters, as Gus Meyer says. Good insight. And just remember, he's writing this book, or, well, at least he got it published just a few years before the Federal Reserve came into existence. That was in 1913, and so, wow, this was probably pretty incendiary. No wonder it sat unpublished for 10 years, like it said in his obituary. Let's continue on with the book now. In that fierce, pervading, competitive strife, the banks were the final exploiters. Sparsely organized and wholly unprotected, the worker was in the complete power of the trader, manufacturer, and landowner. In turn, such of these divisions of the propertied class as were not themselves sharers in the ownership of banks were at the mercy of the banking institution. At any time, upon some pretext or other, the banks could arbitrarily refuse the latter class credit or accommodation, or harass its victims in other ways equally as destructive. As business was largely done in expectations of payment, in other words, on credit, as it is now, this was a serious, often a desperate blow to the lagging or embarrassed brothers in trade. Banks were virtually empowered by law to ruin or enrich any individual or set of individuals. As the banks were then founded and owned by men who were themselves traders or landholders, this power was crushingly used against competitors. Armed with the strong power of law, the banks overawed the mercantile world. They thrived on the industry, misfortune or ruin of others, and swayed politics and elections. Damn, lay it on, man, come on. The bank men loaned money to themselves at an absurdly low rate of interest. But for loans of money to all others, they demanded a high rate of interest, which, in periods of commercial distress, overwhelmed the borrowers. Nominally, banks were restricted to a certain standard rate of interest, but by various subterfuges, they easily evaded these provisions and exacted usurious rates. Banks and their power. These, however, were far from being the worst features. Oh, really? That's funny. These were far from being the worst features? All right, tell me about it. The most innocent of their great privileges was that of playing fast and loose with the money confidingly entrusted to their care by a swarm of depositors who either worked for it, or, for the matter of that, often stole it. Bankers, like pawnbrokers, ask no questions. Oh my God, isn't that so true? Man, this chapter is fire right here, let me tell you. The most remarkable of their vested powers was that of manufacturing money. The industrial manufacturer could not make goods unless he had the plant, the raw material, and the labor. But the banker, somewhat like the fabled alchemist, could transmute airy nothing into banknote money and then, by law, force its acceptance. The loan trader or landholder, unsupported by a partnership with law, could not fabricate money, but let trader and landholder band in a company, incorporate, then persuade, wheedle, or bribe a certain entity called a legislature to grant them a certain bit of paper styled a charter, and lo, they were instantly transformed into money manufacturers. Wow, this is hot stuff, man. This chapter is amazing. And just remember, this was a few years before the Federal Reserve came in. They were probably planning it right as this book was published. Continuing on now. A mandate to pray. The simple mandate of law was sufficient authorization for them to prey upon the whole world outside of their charmed circle. With this scrap of paper, they could go forth on the highways of commerce and over the farms and drag in, by the devious, absorbent processes of the banking system, a great part of the wealth created by the actual producers. As it was with taxation, so was it with the burdens of this system. They fell largely upon the worker, whether in the shop or on the farm. When the businessman and the landowner were compelled to pay exorbitant rates of interest, they but apparently had to meet the demands. What these classes really did was to throw the whole of these extra impositions upon the working class, in the form of increased prices for necessaries and merchandise and in augmented rents. But how were these state or government authorizations, called charters, to be obtained? Did not the federal constitution prohibit states from giving the right to banks to issue money? Were not private money factories specifically barred by that clause of the Constitution which declared that no state, quote, shall coin money, emit bills of credit, or make anything but gold or silver a tender in payment of debts, unquote. Here again the power of class domination of government came into compelling effect. The onward sweep of the trading class was not to be balked by such a trifling obstacle as a constitutional provision. At all times when the Constitution has stood in the way of commercial aims, it has been abrogated, not by repeal nor violent overthrow, but by the effective expedient of judicial interpretation. The trading class demanded state-created banks with power of issuing money, and as the courts have invariably in the long run responded to the interests and decrees of the dominant class, a decision was quickly forthcoming in this case to the effect that, quote-unquote, bills of credit were not meant to cover banknotes. This was a new and surprising construction, but judicial decision and precedent made it virtually law, and law a thousandfold more binding than any constitutional insertion. Courts and Constitution. The trading class had already learned the importance of the principle that while it was essential to control lawmaking bodies, it was imperative to have as their auxiliary the bodies that interpreted law. To a large extent, the United States since then has lived not under legislative-made law, but under a purely separate and extraneous form of law which has superseded the legislature product, namely, court law. Although nowhere in the United States Constitution is there even the suggestion that courts shall make law, yet this past century and more they have been gradually building up a formidable code of interpretations which substantially ranks as the most commanding kind of law, and these interpretations have, on the whole, consistently followed and kept pace with the changing interests of the dominant class, whether traders, slaveholders, or the present trusts. This decision of the august courts opened the way for the greatest orgy of corruption and the most stupendous frauds. In New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and other states, a continuous rush to get bank charters ensued. Most of the legislatures were composed of men who, while perhaps not innately corrupt, were easily seduced by the corrupt temptations held out by the traders. There was a deep-seated hostility in many parts of the country on the part of the middling tradesmen, the shopkeepers and the petty merchants, to any laws calculated to increase the power and the privileges of the superior traders and the landowners. Among the masses of workers, most of whom were, however, disfranchised, any attempt to vest the rich with new privileges was received with the bitterest resentment. But the legislatures were approachable. Some members who were put there by the rich families needed only the word as to how they should vote, while others representing both urban and rural communities were swayed by bribes. By one means or another, the traders and landholders forced the various legislatures into doing what was wanted. Omitting the records of other states, a few salient facts as to what took place in New York State will suffice to give a clear idea of some of the methods of the trading class in pressing forward their conquests, in hurling aside every impediment, whether public opinion or law, and in creating new laws which satisfied their extending plans for a ramification of profit-producing interest. If forethought and unswerving aim and singleness of execution mean anything, then there was something sternly impressive in the way in which this rising capitalist class went forward to snatch what it sought and what it believed to be indispensable to its plans. There was no hesitation, nor were there any scruples as to niceties of methods. The end in view was all that counted. So long as that was attained, the means used were considered paltry side issues. And indeed, herein lies the great distinction of action between the world, old property classes, and the contending proletariat. For whereas the one have always campaigned irrespective of law, and particularly by bribery, intimidation, repression, and force, the working class has had to confine its movement strictly to the narrow range of laws which were expressly prepared against it, and the slightest violation of which has called forth the summary vengeance of a society ruled actually, if not theoretically, by the very property classes which set at defiance all law. The banking frauds begin! The chartered monopoly held by the traders who controlled the United States Bank was not accepted passively by others of the commercial class, who themselves wanted financial engines of the same character. The doctrine of states' rights served the purpose of these excluded capitalists as well as it did that of the slaveholders. The states began a course of reeling out bank charters. By 1799, New York City had one bank, the Bank of New York. This admixed the terrorism of trade and politics so overtly that presently an opposition application for a charter was made. This solitary bank was run by some of the old landowning families who fully understood the danger involved in the triumph of the democratic ideas represented by Jefferson. A danger far overestimated, however, since when, as democratic principles did, the property class continued its victorious march for the simple reason that property was able to divert manhood suffrage to its own account, and to aggrandize itself still further on the ruins of every subsequent similar reform expedient. What the agitated masses, for the most part, of that period could not comprehend was that they who hold the possession of the economic resources will indubitably sway the politics of a country until such time as the proletariat, no longer divided but thoroughly conscious, organized, and aggressive, will avail itself of its majority vote to transfer the powers of government to itself. Yeah, I wish that was true, man, but it's never happened. Continuing now with the book. The Bank of New York injected itself virulently into politics and fought the spread of democratic ideas with sordid but effective weapons. If a merchant dared support what it denounced as heretical doctrines, the bank at once blacklisted him by rejecting his notes when he needed cash most. It was now that Aaron Burr, last name B-U-R-R, that adroit leader of the opposition party stepped in. Seconded or instigated by certain traders, he set out to get one of those useful and invaluable bank charters for his backers. Okay, Aaron Burr was a banker, huh? I thought he was just a lawyer. The explanation of how he accomplished the act is thus given. Taking advantage of the epidemic of yellow fever then desolating New York City, he, with much preliminary philanthropic motives, introduced a bill for the apparent beneficent purpose of diminishing the future possibility of the disease by incorporating a company called the Manhattan Company to supply pure, wholesome water. Okay, that sounds all right. Supposing that the charter granted nothing more than this, the explanation goes on, the legislature passed the bill, and was most painfully surprised and shocked when the fact came out that the measure had been so deftly drawn that it, in fact, granted an unlimited charter conferring banking powers on the company. Footnote number one. Oh, yeah, I bet they were just shocked. Shocked.
I'm shocked. Shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
Oh, man. This explanation is probably shallow and deficient. Oh, way to call it, Gus. There you go. Attaboy. It is much more likely that bribery was resorted to, considering the fact that the granting of every successive bank charter was invariably accompanied by bribery. 6 years later, the Mercantile Bank received a charter for a 13-year period, a charter which, it was openly charged by certain members of the assembly, was secured by bribery. These charges were substantially proved by the testimony before a legislative investigating committee. Footnote number two. In 1811, the Mechanics Bank was chartered with a time limit under circumstances indicating bribery. Indeed, so often was bribing done and so pronounced were charges of corruption at frequent sessions of the legislature that in 1812 the assembly, in a heroic spasm of impressive virtue, passed a resolution compelling each member to pledge himself that he had neither taken nor would take, quote, any reward or profit, direct or indirect, for any vote on any measure, unquote. Footnote number three. This resolution was palpably intended to blind the public, for in that identical year, the Bank of America received a charter amid charges of flagrant corruption. Wow, there you go. There's a name probably everybody knows. Guess what? They got their first charter amid charges of flagrant corruption. One assemblyman declared under oath that he had been offered the sum of $500, quote, besides a handsome present for his vote, unquote. Footnote number four. And in that footnote, real quick, Gus mentions that frequently, in those days, the giving of presents was a part of corrupt methods. Continuing out the book. All of the banks except the Manhattan had limited charters. Measures for the renewal of these were practically all put through by bribery. Footnote number five. And in this footnote, Gus Myers notes that, quote, the members of the legislature themselves sometimes participated in the benefits growing out of charters created by their own votes. If 10 banks were chartered at one session, 20 must be chartered the next, and 30 the next. The cormorants could never be gorged. If at one session you bought off a pack of greedy lobby agents, they returned with increased numbers and more voracious appetite, unquote. And that's from Hammond, Volume 2, or Chapter 2, page 447 to 448. So, yeah, it's like, when, you know what, that's perfect example. Once they found out, hey, you can bribe the legislators for bank charters, it like started with 10 banks one day, and then the next day there are 20 more people there to get new charters. And then they bribe them off, and then the next day 30 more. So it's like a self-perpetuating cycle. Oh my gosh. That is, I mean, this is the real history of banking that nobody knows. I mean, everybody suspects it, but Gus Myers has got it documented here that, hey, every time a bank charter came up, it was Bribery, 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 corruption, corruption, corruption. That's the real history of banking. Damn. This is an amazing chapter. Continuing on now. Thus, in 1818, the charter of the Merchants' Bank was renewed until 1832, and renewed after that. The chartering of the Chemical Bank, that staid and most eminently respectable and solid New York institution of today, was accomplished by bribery. The Chemical Bank was an outgrowth of the Chemical Manufacturing Company, the plant and business of which were bought expressly as an excuse to get a banking auxiliary. The Golay brothers were among the founders of this bank. In fact, many of the great landed fortunes were inseparably associated with the frauds of the banking system. Money from land was used to bribe legislatures, and money made from the banks was employed in buying more land. The promoters of the Chemical Bank set aside a considerable sum of money and $50,000 in stock for the bribery fund. Footnote number 6. No sooner had it received its charter than it began to turn out reams of paper money based upon no value, which paper was paid as wages to its employees as well as circulated generally. So year after year, the bribery went on industriously without cessation. Bribery, a crime in name only. Were the bribers ever punished? Their illicitly gotten charters declared forfeited, and themselves placed under the ban of virtuous society? Far, very far from it. Oh, and don't make me play that clip again. About when was the last time you prosecuted a bank?
And so the question I'm really asking is, can you identify when you last took the Wall Street banks to trial?
I will have to get back to you with the specific information.
Never is the answer. Never, 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 never. This is 1800s. This is 1824 I'm reading. 1818. When was that last one? 1832. This is the start of America. 1805. 1812. 1811. The answer is, has a Wall Street bank ever? I mean, just think, you know, I give props to Elizabeth Warren for asking that question in that clip, but that just shows such a lack of a knowledge of history. When was the last time you ever prosecuted a Wall Street bank? Never. Never. I wonder if you could ever find a time when they went to jail. I mean, seriously, somebody's gotta look that up. I think it's never. I gotta get back to you on that with that information. Ha ha ha. Yeah, well, Pride will never find it, so she's not gonna get back to you. But, you know, again, I don't want to knock Elizabeth Warren, but, you know, she did her thing in there. I mean, you know, she's like Ron Paul, you know, all bark, no bite. But still, it's, you know, that just shows such a lack of knowledge of history. Okay, I'm straying, though. Let's, man, let's get back to it here. Continuing with this amazing book. The men who did the bribing were of the very pinnacle of social power, elegance, and position, or quickly leaped to that height by reason of their wealth. They were among the foremost landholders and traders of the day. By these, and a wide radius of similar means, they amassed wealth or greatly increased wealth already accumulated. The ancestors of some of the most conspicuous multi-millionaire families of the present were deeply involved in the perpetration of all of those continuous frauds and crimes. Peter Golay and his sons, Peter P. and Robert, for instance, and Jacob Lorillard, who for many years was president of the Merchants' Bank. No stigma attached to these wealth graspers. Their success as possessors of riches at once, by the automatic processes of a society which enthroned wealth, elevated them to be commanding personages in trade, politics, orthodoxy, and the highest social spheres. The cropped convict, released from prison, was followed everywhere by the jeers and branding of a society which gloated over his downfall and which forever reminded him of his infamy. But the men who waded onto wealth through the muck of base practices and by means of crimes a millionfold more insidious and dangerous than the offense of the convict were not only honored as leading citizens, but they became the extolled and unquestioned dictators of that supreme trading society which made modes, customs, and laws. It was a society essentially built upon money. Consequently, he who was dexterous enough to get possession of the spoils experienced no difficulty in establishing his place among the select and anointed. His frauds were forgotten or ignored. Only the fact that he was a rich man was remembered. And yet, what is more natural than to seek and accept the obeisance lavished upon property in a scheme of society where property is crowned as the ruling power? And let me just stop and say that obeisance, I had to look that up, but that is a movement of the body expressing deep respect or deferential courtesy, as before a superior, like a bow, a curtsy, or other similar gesture. But I think in this case it means like deference or, you know, giving homage or something like that. So there you go. Let's get back to the book now. In the rude centuries previously, mankind exalted physical prowess. He who had the greatest strength and wielded the deftest strokes became victor of the judicial combat and gathered in laurels and property. But now we have arrived at the time when the cunning of mind supplants the cunning of muscle. Bribery takes the place of brawn. The contestants fight with statutes instead of swords. And this newer plan, which some have decried as degenerate, is a great advance over the old, for thereby has brute force been legally abandoned, in personal quarrels at least, and that cunning of mind which has held sway is the first evidence of the reign of mind, which from a low order will universally develop noble and supereminent qualities charged with the good, and that alone of the human race. Astor's Banking Activities. With this preliminary sketch, we can now proceed to a consideration of how Astor profited from the banking system. We see that constantly the bold spirits of the trading class, with a part of the money made or plundered in some direction or other, were bribing representative bodies to give them exceptional rights and privileges which, in turn, were made the fertile basis for further spoliation. Astor was a stockholder in at least 4 banks, the charters of which had been obtained or renewed by trickery and fraud, or both. He owned 1,000 shares of the capital stock of the Manhattan Company, 1,000 of the Merchants Bank, 500 of the Bank of America, 1,604 of the Mechanics Bank. He also owned at one time considerable stock in the National Bank, the charter of which it was strongly suspected had been obtained by bribery. There is no evidence that he himself did the actual bribing, or was in any way concerned in it. In all of the legislative investigations following charges of bribery, the invariable practice was to throw the blame upon the wicked lobbyists, while professing the most naive astonishment that any imputation should be cast upon any of the members of the honorable legislature. Wow! You just laid out... I mean, look at today. Look at today in government. What is it? Always some damn lobbyists. Man, I can't tell you how many times I've heard somebody say, well, you just got these lobbyists that are constantly in the halls of government and they're ruining everything. And yet nobody bothers to say, well, like, they walk around with bags full of cash or briefcases full of cash or whatever it is. You know, it's not like that, but you get the idea. I'm just painting a picture, right? So they're like, hey, man, you know, you pass this law for us, we'll give you some money, yeah, yeah. But, and I know there's for sure one, I can, I'm going to put one example in here. But nobody ever seems to be like, I wonder if the politicians actually solicit the bribes.
Now, you want to talk about unbelievable corruption in Congress? Listen to this phone call that Eleanor Holmes Norton left, Congresswoman, on a lobbyist answer machine. They're so brazen that she thought nothing of leaving this message. Listen.
Hey, this is Eleanor Norton, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. I noticed that you have given to other colleagues on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. I am a senior member, a 20-year veteran, and am chair of the Subcommittee on Economic Development, Public Buildings, and Emergency Management. I'm handling the largest economic development project in the United States. I was, frankly, surprised to see that we don't have a record, so far as I can tell, of your having given to me, despite my long and deep work. In fact, it's been my major work on the committee and subcommittee has been essentially in your sector. I'm simply candidly calling to ask for a contribution.
And that's exactly what Gus is saying. It's like every time there's a bribery investigation, it's always a damn lobbyist. But nobody ever looks at the honorable members of the legislature, and maybe we should. Everybody take note of that. I'm going to take note of that. I never thought about it like that before, but man, doesn't that make a ton of sense. Way to go, Gus, man. This chapter. Oh, man, this book. Woo! All right, let's continue on. As for the bribers behind the scenes, their names seldom or never were brought out or divulged. In brief, these investigations were all of that rose water order, generally termed whitewashing. But whether Astor personally bribed or not, he at any rate consciously profited from the results of bribery. And moreover, it is not probable that his methods in the East were different, except in form, from the debauching and exploitation that he made a system of in the fur regions. It is not outside the realm of reasonable conjecture to suppose that he either helped to debauch or connived at the corruption of legislatures, just as in another way he debauched Indian tribes. Furthermore, his relations with Burr in one notorious transaction are sufficient to justify the conclusion that he held the closest business relations with that political adventurer who lived next door to him at number 221 Broadway. This transaction was one which was partially the outcome of the organization of the Manhattan Bank, and was a source of millions of dollars of profit to Astor and to his descendants. A century or more ago, Trinity Church owned three times the extent of even the vast real estate that it now holds. A considerable part of this was the gift of that royal Governor Fletcher, who, as has been set forth, was such a master hand at taking bribes. There long existed a contention upon the part of New York State, a contention embodied in numerous official records, that the land held for centuries by Trinity Church was usurped, that Trinity's title was invalid, and that the real title vested in the people of the city of New York. In 1854-55, the land commissioners of New York State, deeply impressed by the facts as marshaled by Rutger B. Miller, in his name, first name R-U-T-G-E-R, Rutger, last name Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R. Footnote number 7, recommended that the state bring suit. But with the filing of Trinity's reply, mysterious influences intervened and the matter was dropped. These influences are frequently referred to in aldermanic documents. To go back, however, in 1767, Trinity Church leased to Abraham Mortier, his last name, M-O-R-T-I-E-R, for 49 years, at a total annual rent of $269 a year, a stretch of land comprising 465 lots in what is now the vicinity bounded by Greenwich, Spring, and Hudson Streets. Mortier used it as a country place until 1797, when the New York legislature, upon the initiative of Burr, developed a consuming curiosity as to how Trinity Church was expending its income. This was a very ticklish question with the pious vestrymen of Trinity, as it was generally suspected that they were commingling business and piety in a way that might, if known, cause them some trouble. The law at that time restricted the annual income of the Trinity Church from its property to $12,000 a year. A committee of investigation was appointed. Of this committee, Burr was made chairman. Howe Astor secured a lease. Burr never really made any investigation. Why? The reason soon came out when Burr turned up with a transfer of the Mortier lease to himself. He at once obtained from the Manhattan Bank a $38,000 loan, pledging the lease as security. When his duel with Hamilton forced Burr to flee the country, Astor promptly came along and took the lease off his hands. Astor, it was said, paid him $32,000 for it, subject to the Manhattan Bank's mortgage. At any rate, Astor now held this extraordinarily valuable lease. Footnote number 8. And in footnote number 8 here, Gus Myers notes that in all of the official communications of Trinity Church up to 1867, this lease is referred to the Burr or Astor lease. And then he names a couple documents where he draws that from. I will say, go onto the website and read those. And he also notes here in the same footnote, he says, upon returning from exile, Burr tried to break his lease to Astor, but the lease was so astutely drawn that the courts decided in Astor's favor. All right, continuing on with the book here. At any rate, Astor now held this extraordinarily valuable lease. He immediately released it in lots, and as the city fast grew, covering the whole stretch with population and buildings, the lease was a source of great revenue to him and his heirs. Footnote number 9. And in this footnote, Gus Myers writes, in his descriptive work on New York City of a half century ago, Matthew Hale Smith in Sunshine and Shadow in New York, pages 121 to 22, tells this story, quote, the Morley, or Mortier, lease was to run until 1867. Persons who took the leases supposed that they took them for the full term of the Trinity lease. John Jacob Astor was too far-sighted and too shrewd for that. Every lease expired in 1864, leaving him, William B. Astor, the founder's heir, the reversion for 3 years, putting him in possession of all the buildings and all of the improvements made on the lots, and giving him the right of renewal, unquote. Smith's account is faulty. Most of the leases expired in 1866. The value of the reversions was very large. So that's the end of the footnote there, and yeah, I mean, God, this guy was so crafty, man. Continuing with the book now. As a Lutheran, Astor could not be a vestryman of Trinity Church. Anthony Lispenard, his last name L-I-S-P-E-N-A-R-D, however, it may be passingly noted, was a vestryman, and as such mixed piety and business so well that his heirs became possessed of millions of dollars by the mere fact that in 1779, when a vestryman, he got a lease for 83 years of 81 Trinity lots adjacent to the Astor leased land at a total annual rental of $177.50. Footnote number 10. It was by the aid of the banking system that the trading class was greatly enabled to manipulate the existing and potential resources of the country and to extend invaluable favors to themselves. In this system, Astor was a chief participant. For many years, the banks, especially in New York State, were empowered by law to issue paper money to the extent of 3 times the amount of their capital. The actual specie was seized hold of by the shippers, and either hoarded or exported in quantities to Asia or Europe, which, of course, would not handle paper money. By 1819, the banks in New York had issued $12,500,000, and the total amount of specie to redeem this fiat stuff amounted to only $2 million. These banknotes were nothing more or less than irresponsible promises to pay. What became of them? What the workers got as wages? Well, what indeed became of them? They were imposed upon the working class as payment for labor. Although these banknotes were subject to constant depreciation, the worker had to accept them as though they were full value. But when the worker went to buy provisions or pay rent, he was compelled to pay 1/3 and often 1/2 as much as the value represented by those banknotes. Sometimes in crises, he could not get them cashed at all. They became pitiful souvenirs in his hands. Oh, man. This fact was faintly recognized by a New York Senate committee when it reported in 1819 that every artifice in the wit of man had been devised to find ways of putting those notes into circulation. That when the merchant got his depreciated paper, he, quote, settled it upon the departments of productive labor, unquote. The farmer and the mechanic alike went on the report, quote, have been invited to make loans and have fallen victims to the avarice of the banker. The result has been the banishment of metallic currency, the loss of commercial confidence, fictitious capital, increase of civil prosecutions, and multiplication of crimes, unquote. Footnote number 11. What the committee did not see was that by this process, those in control of the banks had, with no expenditure, possessed themselves of a considerable part of the resources of the country, and had made the worker yield up 2x and 3x as much of the produce of his labor as he had to give before the system was started. The large amount of paper money, without any basis of value whatever, was put out at a heavy rate of interest. When the merchant paid his interest, he charged it up as extra cost on his wares. And when the worker came to buy these same wares, which he or some fellow worker had made, he was charged a high price which included 3 things all thrown upon him: rent, interest, and profit. The banks indirectly sucked in a large portion of these 3 factors, and so thoroughly did the banks control legislation that they were not content with the power of issuing spurious paper money. They demanded, and got through, an act exempting bank stock from taxation. Oh, say it ain't so. Thus, year after year, this system went on, beggaring great numbers of people, enriching the owners of the banks, and virtually giving them a life and death power over the worker, the farmer, and the floundering, struggling small businessman alike. The laws were but slightly altered. The great profits of the banks, reported a New York Senate Committee on Banks and Insurance in 1834, quote, arise from their issues. It is this privilege which enables them, in fact, to coin money, to substitute their evidences of debt for a metallic currency, and to loan more than their actual capitals. A bank of $100,000 capital is permitted to loan $250,000, and thus receive an interest on 2.5x the amount actually invested. Wow. Footnote number 12 right there. Yeah, all right, man. Hold on. That is, boy, it's a real government document, huh? Document number 108, New York Senate Documents, 1834, Volume 2. Gus Myers notes that, from this footnote, that the committee stated that banks in the state outside of New York City, after paying all expenses, divided 11% among the stockholders in 1833 and had on hand as surplus capital 16% on their capital. New York City banks paid larger dividends. Wow, okay, so there's a document that actually talks about fractional reserve banking. Continuing with the book now. The Working Men's Party Protest. It cannot be said that all of the working men were apathetic, or that some did not see through the fraud of the system. They had good reason for the deepest indignation and exasperation. The terrible injustices piled upon them from every quarter, the low wages that they were forced to accept, often in depreciated or worthless banknotes, the continually increasing exactions of the landlords, the high prices squeezed out of them by monopolies, the arbitrary discriminations of law, these were not without their effect. The Working Men's Party, formed in 1829 in New York City, was the first and most ominous of these proletarian uprisings. Its resolutions read like a proletarian declaration of independence, and would unquestionably have resulted in the most momentous agitation had it not been that it was smothered by its leaders, and also because the slavery issue long obscured purely economic questions. Resolved, ran its resolutions adopted at Military Hall, October 19, 1829. Quote, in the opinion of this meeting that the first appropriation of the soil of the state to private and exclusive possession was eminently and barbarously unjust, that it was substantially feudal in its character, inasmuch as those who received enormous and unequal possessions were lords, and those who received little or nothing were vassals. That hereditary transmission of wealth on the one hand, and poverty on the other, has brought down to the present generation all the evils of the feudal system, and that, in our opinion, is the prime source of all our calamities. Unquote. After declaring that the Working Men's Party would oppose all exclusive privileges, monopolies, and exemptions, the resolution proceeded. Quote, we consider it an exclusive privilege for one portion of the community to have the means of education in colleges, while another is restricted to common schools or perhaps, by extreme poverty, even deprived of the limited education to be acquired in those establishments. Our voice, therefore, shall be raised in favor of a system of education which shall be equally open to all, as in a real republic it should be. Unquote. Finally, the resolutions told what the Working Men's Party thought of the bankers and the banking system. The bankers were denounced as, quote, the greatest knaves, impostors, and paupers of the age. Unquote. The resolution went on, quote, as banking is now conducted, the owners of the banks receive annually of the people of the state not less than $2 millions in their paper money, and it might as well be pewter money, for which there is and can be nothing provided for its redemption upon demand. Unquote. The mockery that went up from all that was held influential, respectable, and stable when these resolutions were printed was echoed far and wide. They were looked upon first as a joke, and then when the Working Men's Party began to reveal its earnestness and strength as an insolent challenge to constituted authority, to wealth and superiority, and as a menace to society. Radicalism versus respectability. The Courier and Inquirer, owned by Webb and Noah, in the pay of the United States Bank, burst out into savage invective. It held the Working Men's Party up to opprobrium as an infidel crowd, hostile to the morals and the institutions of society and to the rights of property. And let me just stop and say I had to look up opprobrium, but that means the disgrace or the reproach incurred by conduct considered outrageously shameful, or also infamy. So there you go. Continuing with the book now. Nevertheless, the Working Men's Party proceeded with an enthusiastic, almost ecstatic campaign and polled 6,000 votes, a very considerable number compared to the whole number of voters at the time. By 1831, however, it had gone out of existence. The reason was that it allowed itself to be betrayed by the supineness, incompetence, and, as some said, the treachery of its leaders, who were content to accept from a legislature controlled by the propertied interests various mollifying sops, which slightly altered certain laws, but which in no great degree redounded to the benefit of the working class. For a few bits of counterfeit, this splendid proletarian uprising, glowing with energy, enthusiasm, and hope, allowed itself to be snuffed out of existence. And, boy, you just look around at any movement. What always happens? The leaders get bought off or infiltrated, and the whole thing gets spun out of existence. Continuing with the book now. What a tragedy was there, and how futile and tragic must inevitably be the fate of any similar movement, Gus calls it, which depends not upon itself, not upon its own intrinsic collective strength and wisdom, but upon the say-so of leaders who come forward to assume leadership. Wow, he nails it right there. Representing only their own timidity of thought and cowardice of action, they often end by betraying the cause placed confidingly in their charge. That class which for these immemorial generations has done the world's work, and as long has been plundered and oppressed and betrayed, thus had occasion to learn anew the bitter lesson taught by the wreckage of the past, that it is from itself that the emancipation must come, that it is itself which must essentially think, act, and strike, that its forces, long torn asunder and dispersed, must be marshaled in invulnerable compactness and iron discipline, and so that its hosts may not again be routed by strategy. No man or set of men should be entrusted with the irrevocable power of executing its decrees, for too often has the courage, boldness, and strength of the many been shackled or destroyed by the compromising weakness of the leaders. The Panic of 1837. Passing over the Equal Rights Movement in 1834, which was a diluted revival of the Working Men's Party, and which also was turned into sterility by the treachery of its leaders, we arrive at the Panic of 1837, the time when Astor, profiting from misfortune on every side, vastly increased his wealth. The Panic of 1837 was one of those periodic financial and industrial convulsions resulting from the chaos of capitalist administration. No sooner had it commenced than the banks refused to pay out any money other than their worthless notes. For 33 years they had not only enjoyed immense privileges, but they had used the powers of government to ensure themselves a monopoly of the business of manufacturing money. In 1804, the legislature of New York State had passed an extraordinary law called the Restraining Act. This prohibited, under severe penalties, all associations and individuals, not only from issuing notes, but, quote, from receiving deposits, making discounts or transacting any other business which incorporated banks may or do transact, unquote. Thus the law not only legitimized the manufacture of worthless money, but guaranteed a few banks a monopoly of that manufacture. Another restraining act was passed in 1818. The banks were invested with the sovereign privilege of depreciating the currency at their discretion, and were authorized to levy an annual tax upon the country, nearly equivalent to the interest on $200 million of deposits in circulation. Wow. On top of these acts, the legislature passed various acts compelling the public authorities in New York City to deposit public money with the Manhattan Company. This company, although, as we have seen, expressly chartered to supply pure water to the city of New York, utterly failed to do so. At one stage, the city tried to have its charter revoked on the ground of failure to carry out its chartered function, but the courts decided in the company's favor. Footnote number 13. At the outbreak of the Panic of 1837, the New York banks held more than $5.5 million of public money. When called upon to pay only about $1 million of that sum, or the premium on it, they refused. But far worse was the experience of the general public. When they frantically besieged the banks for their money, the bank officials filled the banks with heavily armed guards and plug uglies, with orders to fire on the crowd in case a rush was attempted. Footnote number 14. In every state, conditions were the same. In May 1837, not less than 800 banks in the United States suspended payment, refusing a single dollar to the government whose deposits of $30 million they held, and to the people in general who held $120 million of their notes. No specie whatever was in circulation. The country was deluged with small notes, colloquially termed shin plasters. Oh, and that word, let me spell that as S-H-I-N-P-L-A-S-T-E-R-S. Shin plasters. Of every form and every denomination, from the alleged value of 5 cents to that of $5, they were issued by every business, individual, or corporation for the purpose of paying them off as wages to their employees. The worker was forced to take them for his labor or starve. Moreover, the shin plasters were so badly printed that it was not hard to counterfeit them. The counterfeiting of them quickly became a regular business. Immense quantities of the stuff were issued. The worker never knew whether the bills paid him for his work were genuine or counterfeit, although essentially there was not any great difference in the basic value between the two. Zinger. And that's footnote 14a. The resulting widespread destitution. Now, the storm broke. Everywhere was impoverishment, ruination, and beggary. Every bank official in New York City was subject to arrest for the most serious frauds and other crimes. But the authorities took no action. Man, why am I not surprised? On the contrary, so complete was the dominance of the banks over the government, footnote 15, that they hurriedly got the legislature to pass an act practically authorizing a suspension of specie payments. The consequences were appalling. Thousands of manufacturing, mercantile, and other useful establishments in the United States, reported a New York Senate committee, quote, have been broken down or paralyzed by the existing crisis. In all our great cities, numerous individuals who, by a long course of regular business, had acquired a competency have suddenly been reduced with their families to beggary. Unquote. Footnote number 16. New York City was filled with the homeless and unemployed. In the early part of 1838, one-third of all the persons in New York City who subsisted by manual labor were wholly or substantially without employment. Not less than 10,000 persons were in utter poverty and had no other means of surviving the winter than those afforded by the charity of neighbors. The almshouses and other public and charitable institutions overflowed with inmates, and 10,000 sufferers were still uncared for. And all right, let me make the little asides here. Footnote number 15. Gus writes a little bit about that. I'm going to read that. He writes, and footnote number 15 was about the dominance of the banks over the government. Gus Myers notes, In the course of this work, the word government is frequently used to signify not merely the functions of the national government, but those of the totality of government, state and municipal, no less than national. So he's saying that not only did they control the federal government, but also the banks dominated the states and the cities. Continuing on, the prevailing system, as was pointed out even by the conventional and futile reports of legislative committees, was one inevitably calculated to fill the country with beggars, vagrants, and criminals. This important fact was recognized, although in a remote way, by de Beaumont and de Tocqueville, who, however, had no fundamental understanding of the deep causes, nor even of the meaning of the facts which they so accurately gathered. In their elaborate work on the penitentiary system in the United States, published in 1833, they set forth that it was their conclusion that in the four states, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania, the prison system of which they had fully investigated, almost all of those convicted for crimes from 1800 to 1830 were convicted for offenses against property. In these four states, collectively, with a population amounting to one-third of that of the Union, not less than 91.29 out of every 100 convictions were for crimes against property, while only 8.66 of every 100 were for crimes against persons, and 4.05 of every 100 were for crimes against morals. In New York State singly, 93.56 of every 100 convictions were for crimes against property, and 6.26 for crimes against persons. Footnote number 16A. Property and crime. Thus we see from these figures, filled with such tragic eloquence, the economic impulse working at bottom, and the property system corrupting every form of society. But here are vast differences to be noted. Just as in England, the aristocracy for centuries had made the laws, and had enforced the doctrine that it was they who should wield the police power of the state, so in the United States, to which the English system of jurisprudence had been transplanted, the propertied interest constituting the aristocracy, made and executed the laws. De Beaumont and de Tocqueville passingly observed that while the magistrates in the United States were plebeian, yet they followed out the old English system. In other words, they enforced laws which were made for and by the American aristocracy, the trading classes. The views, aims, and interests of these classes were so thoroughly entrenched in law that the fact did not escape the keen notice of these foreign investigators. The Americans, descendants of the English, they wrote, quote, have provided in every respect for the rich and hardly at all for the poor. In the same country where the complainant is put in prison, the thief remains at liberty if he can find bail. Murder is the only crime whose authors are not protected. Footnote 17. The mass of lawyers see in this nothing contrary to their ideas of justice and injustice, nor even to their democratic institutions. Unquote. Footnote number 18. And in footnote number 17, where when de Beaumont and de Tocqueville mention that murder is the only crime whose authors are not protected, Gus Myers notes that this is a complete error. Walling, for more than 30 years superintendent of police of New York City, says in his memoirs that he never knew an instance of a rich murderer who was hanged or otherwise executed. And have we all not noted likewise? And, wow. I guess so. Even in this book, what about Astor, man? He was implicated in ton of crimes, including murder and treason, but nah, he never got hung. So yeah, I guess, I bet you that still holds true today. Continuing with the book now. The system, how it worked. The system then frequently forced the destitute into theft and mendicancy. What resulted? Laws inconceivably harsh and brutal, enacted by and in behalf of property rights, were enforced with a vigor which seems unbelievable were it not that the fact is verified by the records of thousands of cases. Those convicted for robbery usually received a life sentence. They were considered lucky if they got off with 5 years. The ordinary sentence for burglary was the same, with variations. Forgery and grand larceny were punishable with long terms ranging from 5 to 7 years. These were the laws in practically all the states with slight differences. But they applied to whites only. The Negro slave criminal had a superior standing in law for the simple reason that while the whites were free labor, Negroes were property, and of course it did not pay to send slaves to prison. Wow, that's pretty incendiary, but think upon it. In Maryland and in most southern states where the slaveholders were both makers and executors of law, the slaves need have no fear of prison. Quote, the slaves, as we have seen before, are not subject to the penal code of the whites. They are hardly ever sent to prison. Slaves who commit grave crimes are hung. Those who commit heinous crimes, not punishable with death, are sold out of state. In selling him, care is taken that his character and former life are not known, because it would lessen his price. Unquote. Thus wrote de Beaumont and de Tocqueville, and in so writing they handed down a fine insight into the methods of that southern property class which assumed so exalted an opinion of its honor and chivalry. And, you know, it's interesting, but, you know, there's some things in there. Just think about the slave. Yeah, he wasn't sent to prison, but he was kind of already in prison, so to speak. I mean, you know, you're not in a cage all the time, but still, you know, there's some similarities, that's true. And yeah, most of the time, well, they're just whipped or put to death. And I don't, you know, it's a fine line of what's better, being in prison or being a slave or being whipped for committing a crime, or it's a thing. But it's interesting to think about. This is an interesting topic to ponder upon because it's not talked about very much. Continuing with the book. But the sentencing of the criminal was merely the beginning of a weird life of horror. It was customary at that period to immure prisoners in solitary confinement. There, in their small and reeking cells filled with damps and pestilential odors, they were confined day after day, year after year, condemned to perpetual inactivity and silence. If they presumed to speak, they were brutally lashed with the whip. They were not allowed to write letters nor to communicate with any member of their family, but the law condescended to allow a minister to visit them periodically in order to awaken their religious thoughts and preach to them how bad a thing it was to steal. Many were driven stark mad or died of disease. Others dashed their brains out, while others, when finally released, went out into the world filled with an overpowering hatred of society and all its institutions, and a long-cherished thirst for vengeance against it for having thus so cruelly misused them. Such were the laws made by the property classes, but they were not all. When a convict was released, the law allowed only $3 to be given him to start anew with. Quote, to starve or to steal is too often the only alternative, unquote, wrote John W. Edmonds, last name E-D-M-O-N-D-S, president of the New York Board of Prison Inspectors in 1844. Footnote number 19. If the released convict did steal, he was nearly always sent back to prison for life. And in footnote number 19 about the guy who wrote, to starve or to steal is too often the only alternatives, Gus Myers note that the Prison Association of New York annual reports, 1844 through 46, is where he got that, and he says, it is characteristic of the origin of all of these charity associations that many of the founders of this prison association were some of the very men who had profited by bribery and theft. Horace Greeley, his last name, G-R-E-E-L-E-Y, was actuated by pure humanitarian motives, but such incorporators as Prosper Wetmore, Oldshulfer, and others were, or had been, notorious in lobbying by bribing bank charters through the New York legislature. And those guys' names were Prosper Wetmore, last name W-E-T-M-O-R-E, Oldshulfer, that's U-L-S-H-O-E-F-F-E-R. And, yeah, so he's saying, like, a lot of these guys who ran charitable organizations back then were bankers and lobbyists and lawyers. Continuing with the book now. Equally severe in their way were the laws applying to mendicants and vagrants. 6 months or a year in the penitentiary or workhouse was the usual sentence. After the Panic of 1837, crime, mendicancy, vagrancy, and prostitution tremendously increased, as they always do increase after two events. War, which when over turns into civil life a large number of men who cannot get work, and panics, which chaotically uproot industrial conditions and bring about widespread destitution. Although undeniably great frauds had been committed by the banking class, not a single one of that class went to jail, but large numbers of persons convicted of crimes against property and great batches of vagrants were dispatched there, and also many girls and women who had been hurled by the iron force of circumstances into the horrible business of prostitution. These were some of the conditions in those years. Let it not, however, be supposed that the traders, bankers, and landowners were impervious to their own brand of sensibilities. They dressed fastidiously, went to church, uttered hallelujahs, gave dainty receptions, formed associations to dole out alms, and kept up prices and rents. Notwithstanding the general distress, rents in New York City were greater than were paid in any other city or village upon the globe. Footnote number 20. All right, and that's the end of chapter 4. Gosh, that was another long one. I tried to keep it short, but there was some... Man, this thing started out with some fire on the banking business. This is good stuff. And it's kind of funny there at the end that Gus Myers said, oh yeah, these, you know, don't think that the landowners and stuff and bankers through this panic of 1837, don't think they just kept on in their lavish ways. They put on a fastidious facade, he says, and he went to church, they uttered their hallelujahs, gave dainty receptions, formed associations to dole out alms, and of course he's got a zinger up at the end. They kept up the prices and the rents. So yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, it's always the way. They got a little facade like, oh, we're helping out, but at the same time, don't think I'm lowering my prices to help you. Don't think I'm cutting your rent just because times are tough. But anyways, there we go. That's it. Another episode in the bags. This has been the History of America's 1%, and we have been reading from The History of Great American Fortunes by Gustavus Myers. This book was published by the Charles H. Kerr & Company of Chicago, and this printing was in 1911. And as always, this has been history that you're not supposed to know about.
Headed down to Boulevard El Paso. thought I